Grade 4 Conference, Lecture 36, Norse Mythology, Part 14. I've mentioned Rudolf Steiner's indication that Loki can be construed as Lucifer, making a special guest appearance in Norse mythology, because he does not appear too directly in many ancient cultures. And I've already spoken about Steiner's picture of Lucifer as the ruler of the Earth in the first half of Earth evolution proper, that is. So his rule comes to an end with the crucifixion, with the mystery of Golgotha. And after that, although he still fights to retain his power, he more and more becomes a softened force in increasingly modern times, as Ahriman is now given the rightful rulership over Earth evolution. Once again, for a period of time, for the second half of Earth existence. And as Steiner points out, though Lucifer and Ahriman are in ceaseless battle with one another, because the world rules with the principle of balance, surely enough, if Luciferic forces get strong enough, Ahrimanic forces will rise up. If Ahriman grows too strong in one way or another, there's going to be a Luciferic reaction. Sometimes this takes long, long periods of time to fully develop, but in the mythologies, this is often shown as a kind of pendulum swing going on. So we meet Loki now, we meet Lucifer, at a time when his powers as ruler of the earth have passed for about 10 centuries. Remember, these myths were being directly experienced. They were direct pictures into the world around the earth held by the Norse right up until about the 10th, 11th centuries AD. So Lucifer no longer has the power he once had, but he still has many of his faculties, many of his capacities, and he's still a divine being of great power. And what happens is that he is living among the Jotuns, at least that part of him which is connected to the Norse people, and that's where he is seen by Odin. And Odin is very drawn to him, and they become blood brothers. They each open their wrists to allow their blood to flow into one another's veins. And with this, then, we see that the other Aesir cannot, however angry and distressed they grow with Loki and his mischief and eventually his malice, they cannot do him harm. They come very close to it, but he is always able to escape the worst tribulations for his misdeeds because he has the blood of Odin flowing in his veins. And Odin has to be united with him because Lucifer still carries powerful pre-Christian forces. Odin is not yet a Christian god or a Christianized god, no matter how hard Snorri Sturluson tried to make that happen. He is still a pre-Christian god. His leader, his guide, is still Loki. So this is a very, very interesting relationship between two beings whose prime has really passed in a way, between a very lofty, hierarchical being who has voluntarily given up his own advancement so that he can serve humanity, that is Odin, and between an even higher, even more powerful spiritual being, Lucifer, who has unwillingly, but by law, had to give up his great spiritual powers, and now persists as a kind of atavistic yet nonetheless powerful force among the Norse people. So among the things that Loki has is an identification with the force of fire. And of course, fire is able to change one thing into another. It accompanies many chemical reactions. And so Loki is able to change himself into many other shapes. He hasn't yet frozen, hardened into a single solitary shape. And indeed, as Joseph Campbell, the great writer on comparative religion, called the ancient hero the hero with many faces. And so Loki is like that, a god of many, many faces. In the Germanic myths, he's called Logi, and he is seen much more strongly there as the god of fire. But Logi also means word, logos. So he's connected with the capacity of speech. It is said that he taught people to speak in the same way that Odin teaches his people to read, by introducing them to the runes. Now, among the many different things we're going to be seeing, or you'll be seeing as you teach about Loki to your children, he is given, when he lives among the Aesir, he's given a wife, Sigun, who is a very good, upstanding goddess, and who remains loyal to Loki, to the very end of his days. But he chooses, when he goes to live among the Jotun, and he often will disappear and not surface for some period of time, he chooses a kind of fallen Jotun woman, Angerboda, to be his wife. And she gives birth to three children. One of them is a great serpent, long and winding itself around everything, a kind of dragon figure. It's going to be called the Midgard serpent. Secondly is what appears to be a female child, Loki's daughter, and her name is Hel, H-E-L, like the place. And it is said on the one side of her face, she is pale as a ghost. On the other, she is as dark as a deteriorating corpse. Quite a horrific picture to see. And she eventually becomes the queen of the underworld. And then lastly is Fenris, the wolf, a fierce and fast growing creature of tremendous strength and tremendous ferocity. So these are Loki's three children. And we could say that his three children are like the Ahrimanic response to Loki's luciferic nature, that whatever Lucifer does, he sows the seeds of Ahriman taking on an even greater degree of power than he might ordinarily have. We could say that the serpent is very much like the results, the catabolic activity of the astral body in the metabolic system, which, like the Nidhogg serpent that is gnawing away at the tree Yggdrasil, so this Midgard serpent is put away by the gods as a snake serpent biting his own tail, rung around Midgard, the habitation of the human beings. So here the dragon is thrown to the earth and becomes a kind of boundary, even though what he is destroying is always himself, but human beings can and will get caught up in that. The wolf, we could say, represents the fallen life of rhythm, the rhythmical circulatory system, with its tremendous strength, its great stamina, but its ferocity and its endless appetite. So here's another aspect, the wolf, which is seen, as you know, in the second grade fables as an animal of ceaseless, endless hunger. And we'll see it again as the being who suckles Romulus and Remus. And so lays the foundation for the Roman Empire in times to come. And finally, hell, we could say, is the representation of the duality of the astral body in the realm of the head, in the realm of human thinking, or thinking that becomes very, very fixed and very hardened, that which is always dying away, that colorless, dead part of our nature, that is to say, the brain, which, unless it gets filled with spiritual activity, is always falling away, and its gray matter is always assuming a kind of lifeless identity. So this is what Loki breeds in the world. This is what he brings in the world. The possibility of death in the metabolic system, the possibility of ceaseless hunger and anger in the rhythmical system, and the possibility of dead thinking that only lives in the lifeless brain, in the realm of the head. In time, these children of Loki will become the leading forces in the great battle of Ragnarok, in which the gods will be destroyed. And we will see then how the great force of the Norse gods, which arose on the wings of Luciferic inspiration, must fall to its ruin in the light of the destructive forces, or the darkness of the destructive forces of Ahrimanic inspiration. It's kind of a complete picture of Earth evolution, and Loki is central, absolutely central in these stories. Another reason that I think the children sense that of all of the gods and goddesses, Loki, who is by no means the most admirable at all, but he is really the center of Norse mythology, with his ambivalent nature, with the polarities that play so strongly within his being. Loki is very much at the center of this world and bridges Luciferic upbuilding and Ahrimanic destruction. Now we will hear a story in which Loki plays a central role.